Good morning.
Good morning.
This is lecture 3 of the passage from Gyoji, Continuous Practice, from Dogen Zenji Shobo Genzo. I've been using a translation by two people whose last names are Nishijima Cross. And this translation that I want to read this morning of the paragraph we're talking about is from Kaz Tanahashi's Shobo Genzo. So his is a little more condensed. So this is Continuous Practice Part 2, this is an opening paragraph. Bodhidharma came from India to China at the request of his teacher, Venerable Prajnatara. How severe the wind and snow was throughout his three-year journey. How innumerable the waves of the ocean under clouds and mist as he sailed towards an unknown country. This journey is beyond the imagination of those attached to body and mind. This continuous practice is due solely to his great compassionate determination to transmit Dharma and to save deluded beings. It is continuous practice because of his dedication to transmitting the Dharma, because of the all-inclusive world where Dharma is to be transmitted, because the entire world of the 10 directions is the true path, and because the entire world of the 10 directions is the entire world of the 10 directions. What place is not Bodhidharma's palace? What palace can hinder his practice of the way? So that's the paragraph that we've been talking about. And so I'm going to give a third lecture today about this. The first lecture was about Bodhidharma and who he was. And then last time we talked about Dogen Zenji and his trip to China and how important that was for his understanding. And so I want to talk about the kind of general message for us today. And then the last lecture will be about the very last part of that, about the Dharma and how it is all of the universe expressing itself. Okay, so today, you know, we know that from this passage that Dogen and Bodhidharma had very difficult passages. I mean, 3 years to get from India to China, that's pretty serious ocean voyage. And Dogen, we know from his own, I don't think it took him 3 years to get to China. I'm not quite sure how long it takes to sail from Japan to China. But he was nauseated. He had diarrhea. So it wasn't an easy time for him. And I'm sure that when he wrote this about Bodhidharma, he was also thinking about his own experience. Now, when Bodhidharma went to China from India, Bodhidharma was already considered essentially a fully realized being. His teacher had given him transmission, and he was recognized from a traditional point of view as being fully realized. Probably the reality is that Bodhidharma as a person was probably just like the rest of us. He had grasp of some things and maybe not a grasp of some other things, and his teacher had said to him, you know, please, I want you to go to China. I want you to transmit the Dharma to China. And Bodhidharma said, you know, yes, I'm on my way. But he had been practicing for years and years, decades, before that happened. Dogen, on the other hand, we know was in his 20s when he went to China. And he had an essential question that he was trying to solve. He was trying to figure out the nature of his practice. So his epiphany and awakening that allowed him to kind of put it all together happened in China. So that was a place, he didn't go there already having figured the practice out in a certain way that really coalesced for him, that informed him about the totality of his experience until he went to China. So that was a different kind of experience for him than Bodhidharma had. So Dogen says in this passage, this poetic passage about what it was like to make this journey, he said that it wasn't just the weather that might have caused Bodhidharma doubt. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Because this can also be seen as a way to talk about our experience and practice, as a way to talk about our own life and the fact that our life is a passage. Right? in the very kind of sequential way we're born and we go through the various stages of our lives. For me right now, like, for example, going to this meeting, there are people in their 40s at the meeting. And for them, this is a really important time. They're doing something called Gen X, which is a Buddhist group that has to do with people in their 40s. And so they're like, they're saying to each other, "Oh, how old are you? How old are you?" You know, and they're kind of having this shared experience. And I'm thinking, I'm 67. They must think I'm like ancient. And so it's kind of interesting for me because as I get older, I'm passing out of that certain kind of phase into this other phase of my life. And other people are seeing me in different ways. Even though, you know, I'm seeing myself in some ways not any differently than I ever have. And at the same time, there's this passage that's happening, irrespective of what I might think. So there's this way that we are making passage all the time. And it's happening whether we want it to or not, right? That it's sort of relentlessly moving on. And yet, at the same time, we're growing and changing and questioning our lives and working through our lives. We're suffering, we're happy, and it's a journey. So we can think of this as, this is the journey of our life. This is the journey of practice that Dogen's talking about here. This journey, going across these rough seas, having difficult times, and also having epiphanies about the nature of our experience, about our lives. And also, we are all emissaries of our own wisdom, right? As we get older, we have wisdom to impart, and so we have that to offer. Hopefully, we have that in various areas that we have some understanding about the nature of what it is to be a human being in this life. So Dogen says, you know, there wasn't just the weather and the passage itself that might have caused Bodhidharma doubt. So I find that interesting because it very much humanizes him. It puts him in the same category as the rest of us, you know, that our lives cast doubt on things. Our struggles cast doubt on what we're doing. It casts doubts on our understanding of what we thought might be happening, and then suddenly something else happens, and we're like going, "Whoa, what's going on here?" You know. And we also think of Bodhidharma traditionally as being very successful. But you know, the very first part where Bodhidharma goes to China and talks to Emperor Wu, Emperor Wu doesn't get what's going on. And so we love the fact that Bodhidharma says something, you know, "Only don't know," very Zen. And then he walks off, right? That's a kind of an interesting way to start your introduction to a new place where you're going to teach. So we always take it as, you know, that Bodhidharma is like, he's the guy, he's the man, right? He knows. He says, "Only don't know." And sort of like, well, if you want to learn the Dharma, you better catch up to my dust, you know. But in a certain way, it's also like, this person didn't get it, you know. So maybe Bodhidharma said to himself, he said something very Zen and wonderful. He might have also said to himself as a teacher, maybe I need to like work on my methodology. So you know, he was a human being. So what I want to talk about today is, you know, this effort that we make, our understanding of what we're up to, and how we make this vow to sort of keep going on in the midst of this journey. Sometimes the journey is smooth, sometimes it's difficult, but we have doubts. And as Dogen says, we feel like we're battling the waves, the frost, the wind, the snow, you know. And I walk 8 miles to school every day through the snow. That feel. Remember your parents, maybe grandparents now, you know, say, "Oh yeah." My dad used to say, because this is true, I mean, he picked cotton. My grandfather was kind of like a, I want to say a sharecropper exactly in the South, but he rented a farm and they didn't have any running water when my dad was growing up. And so, you know, he would do that thing, walk to school, you know, for several miles. So he actually did that. Most people, I don't think their parents picked cotton after school, but that was something that he did. Must have been kind of tough. So we have these seasons. We have this journey we're making. So the next part of the quote is, and this again is Nishijima's translation, he was going to an unknown country. Ordinary beings who value their body and mind could never conceive of such a journey. Ordinary beings who value their body and mind could never conceive of such a journey. I think that might have been what I sent out as a weekly quote this last time. So what is this unknown journey? What is this unknown country? And I'd like to suggest that this unknown country is impermanence. Right? Our life is impermanent. Everything is impermanent. Nothing stays the same, much as we would like it to. Right? Even the ground doesn't stay the same. And if you're from Texas like I am and there's an earthquake, you get that like real fast. You go, oh, wow, that was an earthquake. So for me, it's like I get the little boop, boop thing. You know, I'm like, earthquake. People grow up here like, boop, boop. They're like, boom, boom. So, yeah. So maybe ultimately we want to be boom, boom. So what? So this way in which that this unknown country is the impermanence of our life, of all life, of the whole universe, of everything that we know, is impermanent, and that just means that it's in constant flux. There are kind of rules of that flux. You know, we have rules that we recognize as being like how plants grow and that kind of thing. There are rules to our life, like we're born and we're going to die. Somebody said, you know, you're lucky if you get out of this life. How's that phrase go? Alive or dead or whatever. But this way that we know we're going to die. And for a long time, as we grow up, we say, if, right? If I die, if I die, if I die, guess what? So that seems like a kind of immutable thing that we are going to die. There's a part of it, we just don't like that idea. And then, of course, the older you get, the less you feel like the way you felt when you were younger, which is you never thought about it. I never thought about it. The older I get, the more I think about it. You're going to die. It probably won't be this morning. We're hoping, you know. But I can see that my life is narrowing down in a certain way, and that there are things that I want to do, and that procrastination is less helpful, you know. But impermanence, just in the way that everything's changing, you know. Where relationships change. Our bodies change, just everything that we can think of. And usually we really want to control things. We really want to understand what's going to happen because we don't want to be uncomfortable. We don't want to suffer. And there's this close association in our minds between being able to control what's happening and not suffering. So in a way, Buddhism is saying, break that connection, you know. We don't have to control everything. Actually, that desire to control everything is the source of suffering. Not impermanence, but the desire to control things is why we suffer. It's also interesting to me that I think as human beings, we actually can think about impermanence. We can fear impermanence. Because usually when we think about change as being bad. We don't think about all the change that happens that's good. You know, that we take that for granted. Like, for example, you know, when you eat, there's a lot of changes going on in that process. Like, if there weren't impermanence, you couldn't take in nutrients. You couldn't eat and have it sustain your body. It requires all these impermanent interacting actions to happen. So when that's working, we never think about it. When it's not working, we do think about it. But when it is working, we're just like, take it for granted. That's great. And then when it's not working, we're going like, oh, I'm so glad it's working today, or I'm, you know, this one's not working, you know, I don't want this. So there's this way that we don't credit the fact that impermanence itself is life itself. Impermanence is life itself. Without impermanence, there could be no life. And yet there's this way in which impermanence is frightening. impermanence is scary. Change is scary. And we anticipate, we can grieve over change before it even happens. We can anticipate loss and grieve about that. We can anticipate something that we want to have in the future and be very happy about that. You know, they say that people, that anticipatory part before vacation, if you're going somewhere, is the part that's like the good stuff. That's where we get the most happiness, is while we're anticipating this thing happening. But on the other hand, it's like when you're anticipating something bad. I don't know about you, but I can have the whole thing happens in my mind. Like I'm having all the feelings and everything's happening, you know? It's like, wake up, you know, that hasn't happened. Come back to reality. It's like, stop suffering. Not necessary. So there's this way in which that we can anticipate and worry about impermanence. We anticipate the loss of things that we want. And that's one of the Four Noble Truths, right? There's a cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is that we want something that we're not getting, we've got something that we don't want, or we're caught up in something called re-becoming, which is a way in which we want to keep perpetuating our sense of self. And we can do that by arguing with people about things. You know, we want our point of view to be preserved and seen, because in some ways the points of view that we have are who we are. So we get attached to that. So that we look at this impermanence, that we see what it actually is. You know, other beings, I don't think, are quite so caught up in this. I hope not. But I think that's one of the, as human beings, we have this definition of sentient. Sentient, from a kind of more Western point of view, would, I think, mean something like being self-aware, for example. Being aware of yourself as a separate entity. And we often determine that, like, what happens when an animal looks in the mirror? That's like one of our criteria, it seems like, of how we determine. We try to ask the question, are you sentient? Do you know you're you? You know, what is my dog doing in its head? You know, so... But from a Buddhist point of view, everything is sentient. There is nothing that's not sentient, that isn't aware in a way of having intrinsic value. That's one of the things that we tend to do, is we say, well, if something doesn't meet our Western criteria of being sentient, then we throw it away in a certain way. It becomes a tool for us to use. That being becomes our tool. We say, well, plants aren't sentient, so I can use them however I want to use them. They don't have a life of their own. They don't have their own sense of self. So there's this, from a Buddhist point of view, we say, well, everything's sentient. Everything is making the world. Everything is in this cooperative relationship. Everything is in flux. Everything is impermanent. Everything is interpenetrating. Everything is making up this process. So we are as dependent upon the what we would call the insentient, as we are upon the sentient, and in that we are dependent upon impermanence. And these are not separate things; they're all the same event happening, and it's called life. We call it life. So we can't, in a way, I think as human beings, we have to take everything for granted and nothing for granted. There's this way in which we know that from our practice, we know that we take nothing for granted, and yet at the same time, we rely upon this impermanent process of interpenetrating, interactive life to happen. Because if it didn't, we could not live. And so we have this gratitude, this deep gratitude for that, as well as a way in which we just say, we just rely on that, that that's going to be there, that that's going to happen. So Dogen says he's going to an unknown country. We are going to an unknown country. Ordinary beings who value their body and mind could never conceive of such a journey. So I would say, Dogen, I think, is talking about ordinary beings here in this way of which not waking up to. So I don't think it matters what ism you call this maturation of our life. Buddhism, some kind of religion, some other kind of way of being, all just altruism. But this way that I think maturity as a human being involves this waking up to your life in a way that is inclusive. Waking up to your life in a way that includes gratitude. Waking up to our lives in a way that accepts impermanence. All of these various things. And that is not ordinary. Because that is actually a very difficult thing to do. Right? I mean, I guess it's possible that somebody can stay selfish and narrow-minded throughout their whole lives because they just don't kind of get, they don't wake up to what's actually going on. But that waking up to what's going on means we also have to let go of things. We have to let go of that narrow view. We have to let go of thinking of ourselves as being in the center of a circle in which everything radiates down to us, right? We have to let go of having everything our way. I mean, that's kind of just, it's like you go to work or whatever and you're in a meeting. And I can't imagine that you could go through life and go to meetings at work and hold on to your own position and always get your own way the whole time. But maybe you could suffer through that for your whole life. Right? Maybe you could like never kind of wake up to compromise. You could never wake up to dialogue and you could just suffer. You know, feel like you're being ignored and browbeaten and turned away and all of that throughout the course of your life. So this waking up, there's an incentive in some ways that we have to wake up, which is that it alleviates our suffering. I mean, we can start there. You know, we can start with a kind of selfish notion of, I'm going to do this practice because it alleviates my suffering. I'm suffering. And often that's how we come to practice, right? Because Buddhist practice is hard. It asks you to do a lot of things. I think any kind of serious practice of transformation asks you to do things that you know, we kind of don't want to do. And it's like being addicted. You know, if you could be addicted with no side effects to something, well, that has its merits, you know. But addiction in and of itself, just by definition of the word, could not exist without side effects, right? Could not exist without something getting in the way that is not helpful, it's not healthy for us. And that's what addiction to self is about, right? Our addiction to self is unhealthy. It causes us suffering. And then we go to the next step, which is, I don't want to cause suffering to others. I think most of us, we come from that initial place of self because as kids, you know, it's like we have to be the center of the circle because that's how children become, they thrive by being the center of that circle. So we start out not separate in a certain way, and we just are taking for our nurturance as infants in order to be able to live. But the more that we grow up, the more we realize we're in this interactive world. It's not just about our notion of what we need or don't need. So we start out in practice, usually suffering, and we come to practice, and as we practice, we realize, oh, you know, it's like, not only is it really nice to alleviate my own suffering, but I can see that doing this practice actually is helpful to other people. And that makes me happy, right? That actually alleviates my suffering and brings joy. So we have to go through this whole process, and that's an unknown country. We don't know what that country is. We have a notion of the map. Like we come to practice, there's a map. And Soto Zen, there's a map, you know. Come and you sit Zazen. You're part of the Sangha. We do things together. You go see your teacher. You know, so I can, you know, name the various things that we do. We go to retreats. We do all these things. So that's the map. But as you're walking the map, that's when stuff happens, right? That's when I don't want to get up in the morning, go to Zazen happens. I like the idea of it. I like the idea a lot, you know. But I don't want to get up in the morning. I'd rather do something else. I'd rather read the paper or go to coffee or whatever, or I'd go to work, whatever. You know, I need this time and space to do that. And see, so when you actually start walking on that, you walk that path, and you talk about it, you go to the teacher and say, you know, I like the idea of going to Zazen in the morning, but actually, so then you start to explore, well, what's that about? It doesn't mean that you go to Zazen in the morning, although, of course, from my point of view, I would love it if you came to Zazen in the morning, but it may not mean that you go to Zazen in the morning, but the fact that there's that map there that's putting pressure on you to look at your life. It's putting pressure on you. Because if we don't have these practices and form, we call them forms, right? If we don't have this path that we're walking, then we're just wandering around. And so when we have the path, then we start to knock up against stuff and say, well, wow, what's that about? What am I doing? What's happening here? And hopefully we're putting ourselves in a wholesome situation, so as that's happening, the guidance that we're receiving is helping us. So this is that unknown country. But from a practice point of view, we're not wandering around in an unknown country. It may be an unknown country, but we do have a map, and we have Sangha, and we have teachings from Buddha, and so we have this kind of GPS system on how to negotiate this unknown country. But what Dogen is saying is that when we go beyond the ordinary, it's because we're willing to make this effort to explore this unknown country. And he's saying that's extraordinary. That's an extraordinary thing. I think that's, we can use that as a way to encourage ourselves to make this journey. Because there will be winds, there will be waves, there will be nausea, you know. It is not like, what? Tiptoe through the tulips. That's not what our life is like all the time. So it is going to be difficult. So we have the Sangha. We have our teachers and Buddhist teachings, the Dharma. So we have this structure that we function in that supports us. Ultimately, Dogen would say, you use the ground, right? The ground of practice, but the ground to get up off the ground. That's our ultimately reality itself is what allows us to stand up. But that's too abstract for us. So we need something else. We need this specificity of our path. So that's a very extraordinary thing when a person decides to do this, no matter what the religion or what ism that you want to call it. That's a very extraordinary thing. And luckily, lots and lots and lots of people are willing to make that journey, right? Lots of people are trying to make that journey. I think there's something inside of us that's inherent to us, to our minds, where we want to make that journey. So in a way, to say it's ordinary, it's extraordinary and also ordinary at the same time, because I think as human beings, we want to do this thing where we say, what is it? You know, what is this life? So it's scary, it's unknown, it's impermanent, and yet we put this step forward and we make this effort. I wrote in my notes here, the Dharma is what buoys us, holds us up. So I was thinking about being on the ocean, you see a buoy, right? You know. So a buoy, I looked it up in the dictionary, is an anchor, float, and a navigation marker in the ocean. It's kind of interesting. So it goes down, right, and it's hooked to the ocean floor, and it's used for navigation. It's also used when you're shipwrecked, and you see a buoy out there, and you swim to it, and you hang on to it for 3 days. hoping that one of those tanker ships that you see in the distance will notice that you're hanging onto that buoy in the midst of the ocean. The Dharma is this buoy. The Buddha Dharma Sangha is how we navigate. It's the buoy that we use in the ocean. It's the anchor of our life. So even though we're fearful and we feel unmoored by impermanence, we can hang on to this buoy and navigate by this buoy of our practice. I think also you have to be part, again, we have to feel like we're part of something bigger than who we are. We have to feel like we're part of this life that we're experiencing. So when we experience impermanence in a way that feels negative to us, we can expand out into something larger. I have a friend whose husband, who's a Dharma teacher, whose friend, whose husband died of a heart attack a couple years back, you know. And the thing that was interesting was watching her navigate through being the head teacher of a fairly large temple. And all of her students were, of course, their students were completely distraught. They were co-teachers, so his students were completely distraught. Her students were completely distraught. She was trying to navigate her husband, you know, just suddenly dying. He was on his way to the Zendo with his Orioki bowls during retreat and had a massive heart attack. So I think about that because watching her practice in the midst of that, I mean, that in some ways, when you're in a long-term relationship, that's the ultimate impermanence, right? On a certain level. And to watch her grieve, because you grieve in a situation like that. It's a shock, you know. And to be honest, to be able to say yes. Remember during his funeral, she said, I am undone, right? But at the same time, she was able to do all, you know, just keep doing the practice. The practice to completely sustain her. So doing this practice does not mean that we are not undone at times, right? That we are not deeply affected by the things that happen to us. So this actually is not, this is not like an escape valve into some kind of perfect world in which we interpret everything that happens to us like Pollyanna or something like that. This is not what the practice is about. The practice is about being a buoy, a navigational device, a grounded event in the midst of the worst that happens. That you are undone and yet you are not undone. You are grieving and yet there's a certain perspective to that. There's a certain way of knowing that it will change. There's a way of knowing that you're in the midst of this very difficult time and you're totally in the midst of that and yet there's still this equanimity in that. There's this equanimity in I am undone. So we watch this person, at least I did, we watch this person who, and many of my colleagues who know them, and watch this and said, you know, wow, this is like pretty amazing. We know this person is suffering such a huge amount, and yet simultaneously she is undone and not undone. And so that's what this deep commitment to practice, I think, is about in this unknown territory. And that is very ordinary and extraordinary simultaneously. So it helps to have this vision. It helps to have this kind of underpinning and notion about what it is that we're doing with our lives, what it is that our practice is, what it is in relationship to this larger thing called our life, what it is in relationship to other people, what it is in relationship to other beings, that we are part of a family. And that family is not just the family of other human beings or other beings and things that are alive right now, but that's also the family of impermanence. That's also the family of the universe of birth and death. So when we're born, we don't have much to say about when we're born, and we don't have much to say about when we die. But this approaching of death and an acceptance and realization of the impermanence of birth and death and that our own death is a kind of impermanence and transition into some other impermanence, some other way of being that still sustains the system, that still sustains the way. So there's this way in which our death is an altruistic offering. Even though we have no control over it, it's still this offering of continuous practice that sustains the world. So if we have that vision of the nature of death, there's a simultaneity of being undone and not undone. Because that becomes our buoy in the midst of this ocean crossing. That becomes this buoy. That becomes the map of this path that we're traveling. Then Dogen said, "This must have been the continuous practice realized solely for the great kind and generous determination to transmit the Dharma to save beings." So this is Bodhidharma's vow. Dogen said, "This must have been the continuous practice realized only from the great kind and generous determination to transmit the Dharma and save deluded beings." So this is about Bodhidharma. But what about us? What about us, right? We have to make a vow. We have to bring this to our mind. We have to very specifically make a vow to ourselves about what we're up to. And that vow, I don't think, can be save all beings. That's just too, you know, too much. But the vow may be, I vow when I go to the grocery store to pay attention. You know, I vow when I go to the grocery store to let a person with less items than I have. You could make a number, 5, you know. I vow to let them go in front of me. Seriously, you know, it has to be something that's very real in your own life. It can't be some kind of abstract thing. You know, what is your deepest intention? Well, my deepest intention may be to save all beings. My deepest intention may be that I want to be generous and intelligent in my compassion. But in some ways, that's a little too abstract, because we also know what it is that pushes our buttons. So my vow is to go into that path of what pushes my buttons, to go into that unknown country with the vow that I'm going to do the hard work, the vow that I'm going to pick that thing that's tough for me to do, and I'm going to rely on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha to support me, to buoy me in the midst of this unknown journey of how in the world do I go to the grocery store and not want to strangle my neighbor. Now, I'm exaggerating. I can go to the grocery store, and that's okay. But there are other situations where, you know, because the universe keeps coming back at us. It's just like we're given so many opportunities in our everyday life to work on these things that cause suffering. So we make this vow. Bodhidharma made a vow, and his vow was to save deluded beings, and that's great for Bodhidharma, but what's your vow? You know? And so I think we can, you know, we can narrow it down, you know, to what that vow is. It can start with something big, because all of us have an altruistic vow. We don't want to cause suffering. We don't want to feel suffering. Well, I think we all agree about that. We all have a vow that we want to practice. We all have the vow that we want to, you know, grow up and be wise and mature and helpful. We all have those vows. But then when that thing happens, you know, it's like, it's gone. All we can think about is, get out of my way, blah, 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 whatever it is that's pushing our buttons. So we have to make that specific vow. And that specificity may change, you know. Like, we're working on something and we get that together. And then what's the next thing? You know, what is that next thing? They're all tied together in this larger altruistic notion. So to make this vow, to do this, make this effort for ourselves and others. So this is, you know, this is the Bodhisattva vow. To save all beings is the kind of bodhisattva vow, in its biggest sense. But as bodhisattvas, we make these vows that really encourage us, hopefully encourage us. And we acknowledge that it's hard. And this is called letting go of the self. What is letting go of the self? Letting go of the self just means that you acknowledge that you're in an interactive relationship. You know, Dogen says in Genjo Koan, to carry the self forward is illusion. Me, 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 my, want, right? Carry the self forward is illusion. To allow myriad things to come forth, that's everything else. Myriad things to come forth is realization. Does that mean myriad things come forth like a tidal wave and flatten you? No. Does that mean myriad things come forth and you say, oh yeah, what I need doesn't matter, take it away? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that we're in a cooperative environment making the world and that we acknowledge that. So every time we have a like or a dislike or a want or whatever, it doesn't mean that, you know, we should have the expectation that we're automatically going to get it regardless of what anybody else might need in the situation. So that we just maybe look around and say, oh, what's actually helpful here? You know, to me and the other person, not just... So it isn't some kind of thing where we're just saying, just run over me. That's not what this is about. But that we live in this cooperative relationship. And we can see so many examples of how this isn't happening in our life, in our world right now. But that's probably why... When we watch, if you watch the news on TV, because I'm in that demographic, right? I still watch television. Like, I even do things like, you know, at 5:30, I watch the CBS Evening News. Like, that's worse than, like, I don't know, watching cable. That's like, and always at the end of these things, they have the feel-good story. Right? That's what I'm getting towards. They always have that feel-good story where you go, oh, that was so altruistic. You know, the 7-year-old went around and collected all the pennies from everybody in town, and then they went out and took it to that old person who lives at the end of the road and completely transformed their life, and yada, 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 right? And it's like you're going, But we need that. We need that. We need to know that, because all we hear about is what isn't working. And what's interesting about these stories is they're always about an ordinary person, right? We all hear about the senators and the president and the, you know, the House of Representatives and whoever it is. Those are all the big guys, right? They are successful people that everybody's heard of, and all we're getting about them is And then we hear about these little folks, the ordinary people who are, you know, out there doing these extraordinary things. Now, you know, all of our senators may be also collecting pennies and doing extraordinary things for the people down the road too, and that may all be happening, but we don't tend to hear about that. But I love the fact that it's on a place where we can meet that in our own lives. We can meet that feel-good story in our own lives. We can do those altruistic things in our own lives. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like we can do it in each moment. We can drive with civility. You know, we can go to the grocery store and be kind to each other. And, you know, I always use these examples, but any other example that you can think of, you know. You're the guy who notices that the person who's trying to get out of your doctor's office with the walker can't get the door open. And you're the guy who stands up and opens the door for them because you're paying attention, you know, to what's going on around you. That kind of altruistic action. Really important for the person who can't get the door open. Right? And that we pay attention in that way. So we make that vow to pay attention. We make that vow to pay attention to what needs to be happening in that moment. What we need to be doing in that moment. So that's that journey. That's the journey that we are making as bodhisattvas in our practice. With all of reality, everything else is making that journey too, in its own way. You know, everything has its own way of being. But this is our way. You know, this is what we're trying to negotiate. So I hope that you take the story of Bodhidharma and Dogen and use it as an inspiration and a buoy for your own life. Thank you.